Selected Essays. My Father's Life. My dad's name was Clevie Raymond Carver. His family called him Raymond, and friends called him CR. I was named Raymond Clevie Carver Jr. I hated the junior part. When I was little, my dad called me Frog, which was okay. But later, like everyone else in the family, he began calling me Junior. He went on calling me this until I was 13 or 14 and announced that I wouldn't answer to that name any longer. So he began calling me Doc. From then until his death on June 17, 1967, he called me Doc, or else Son. When he died, my mother telephoned my wife with the news. I was away from my family at the time, between lives, trying to enroll in the School of Library Science at the University of Iowa. When my wife answered the phone, my mother blurted out, "Raymond's dead." For a moment, my wife thought my mother was telling her that I was dead. Then my mother made it clear which Raymond she was talking about, and my wife said, "Thank God, I thought you meant my Raymond." My dad walked, hitched rides, and rode in empty boxcars when he went from Arkansas to Washington State in 1934 looking for work. I don't know whether he was pursuing a dream when he went out to Washington. I doubt it. I don't think he dreamed much. I believe he was simply looking for steady work at decent pay. Steady work was meaningful work. He picked apples for a time and then landed a construction laborer's job on the Grand Coulee Dam. Note: dam built on the Columbia River, one of the massive public works projects of the New Deal. End of note. After he'd put aside a little money, he bought a car and drove back to Arkansas to help his folks, my grandparents, pack up for the move west. He said later that they were about to starve down there, and this wasn't meant as a figure of speech. It was during that short while in Arkansas, in a town called Leola, that my mother met my dad on the sidewalk as he came out of a tavern. "He was drunk," she said. "I don't know why I let him talk to me. His eyes were glittery. I wish I'd had a crystal ball." They'd met once, a year or so before, at a dance. He'd had girlfriends before her, my mother told me. "Your dad always had a girlfriend, even after we married. He was my first and last. I never had another man. But I didn't miss anything." They were married by a justice of the peace on the day they left for Washington, this big, tall country girl and a farmhand turned construction worker. My mother spent her wedding night with my dad and his folks, all of them camped beside the road in Arkansas. In Omak, Washington, my dad and mother lived in a little place not much bigger than a cabin. My grandparents lived next door. My dad was still working on the dam, and later, with the huge turbines producing electricity and the water backed up for 100 miles into Canada, he stood in the crowd and heard Franklin D. Roosevelt when he spoke at the construction site. "He never mentioned those guys who died building that dam," my dad said. Some of his friends had died there, men from Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. He then took a job in a sawmill in Clatskanie, Oregon, a little town alongside the Columbia River. I was born there, and my mother has a picture of my dad standing in front of the gate to the mill, proudly holding me up to face the camera. My bonnet is on crooked and about to come untied. His hat is pushed back on his forehead, and he's wearing a big grin. Was he going into work or just finishing his shift? It doesn't matter. In either case, he had a job and a family. These were his salad days. In 1941, we moved to Yakima, Washington, where my dad went to work as a saw filer, a skilled trade he'd learned in Clatskanie. When war broke out, he was given a deferment because his work was considered necessary to the war effort. Finished lumber was in demand by the armed services, and he kept his saws so sharp they could shave the hair off your arm. After my dad had moved us to Yakima, he moved his folks into the same neighborhood. By the mid-1940s, the rest of my dad's family, his brother, his sister, and her husband, as well as uncles, cousins, nephews, and most of their extended family and friends, had come out from Arkansas. All because my dad came out first. The men went to work at Boise Cascade, where my dad worked, and the women packed apples in the canneries. And in just a little while, it seemed, according to my mother, everybody was better off than my dad. Your dad couldn't keep money, my mother said. Money burned a hole in his pocket. He was always doing for others. The first house I clearly remember living in, at 1515 South 15th Street in Yakima, had an outdoor toilet. On Halloween night, or just any night for the hell of it, neighbor kids, kids in their early teens, would carry our toilet away and leave it next to the road. My dad would have to get somebody to help him bring it home. Or these kids would take the toilet and stand it in somebody else's backyard, once they actually set it on fire. But ours wasn't the only house that had an outdoor toilet. When I was old enough to know what I was doing, I threw rocks at the other toilets when I'd see someone going inside. This was called bombing the toilets. After a while, though, everyone went to indoor plumbing until, suddenly, our toilet was the last outdoor one in the neighborhood. I remember the shame I felt when my third-grade teacher, Mr. Wise, drove me home from school one day. I asked him to stop at the house just before ours, claiming I lived there. I can recall what happened one night when my dad came home late to find that my mother had locked all the doors on him from the inside. He was drunk, and we could feel the house shudder as he rattled the door. When he'd managed to force open a window, she hit him between the eyes with a colander and knocked him out. We could see him down there on the grass. For years afterward, I used to pick up this colander. It was as heavy as a rolling pin, and imagine what it would feel like to be hit in the head with something like that. It was during this period that I remember my dad taking me into the bedroom, sitting me down on the bed and telling me that I might have to go live with my Aunt Lavon for a while. I couldn't understand what I'd done that meant I'd have to go away from home to live. But this too, whatever prompted it, must have blown over, more or less anyway, because we stayed together, and I didn't have to go live with her or anyone else. I remember my mother pouring his whiskey down the sink. Sometimes she'd pour it all out, and sometimes, if she was afraid of getting caught, she'd only pour half of it out and then add water to the rest. I tasted some of his whiskey once myself. It was terrible stuff, and I don't see how anybody could drink it. After a long time without one, we finally got a car in 1949 or 1950, a 1938 Ford. But it threw a rod the first week we had it, and my dad had to have the motor rebuilt. We drove the oldest car in town, my mother said. We could have had a Cadillac for all he spent on car repairs. One time she found someone else's tube of lipstick on the floorboard, along with a lacy handkerchief. See this? She said to me. Some floozy left this in the car. Once I saw her take a pan of warm water into the bedroom where my dad was sleeping. She took his hand from under the covers and held it in the water. I stood in the doorway and watched. I wanted to know what was going on. This would make him talk in his sleep, she told me. There were things she needed to know, things she was sure he was keeping from her. Every year or so, when I was little, we would take the North Coast Limited across the Cascade Range from Yakima to Seattle and stay in the Vance Hotel and eat, I remember, at a place called the Dinner Bell Cafe. Once we went to Ivar's Acres of Clams and drank glasses of warm clam broth. In 1956, the year I was to graduate from high school, my dad quit his job at the mill in Yakima and took a job in Chester, a little sawmill town in Northern California. The reasons given at the time for his taking the job had to do with a higher hourly wage and the vague promise that he might, in a few years' time, succeed to the job of head filer in this new mill. But I think in the main that my dad had grown restless and simply wanted to try his luck elsewhere. Things had gotten a little too predictable for him in Yakima. Also, the year before, there had been the deaths, within 6 months of each other, of both his parents. But just a few days after graduation, when my mother and I packed to move to Chester, my dad penciled a letter to say he'd been sick for a while. He didn't want us to worry, he said, but he'd cut himself on a saw. Maybe he'd got a tiny sliver of steel in his blood. Anyway, something had happened, and he'd had to miss work, he said. In the same mail was an unsigned postcard from somebody down there telling my mother that my dad was about to die and that he was drinking raw whiskey. When we arrived in Chester, my dad was living in a trailer that belonged to the company. I didn't recognize him immediately. I guess for a moment I didn't want to recognize him. He was skinny and pale and looked bewildered. His pants wouldn't stay up. He didn't look like my dad. My mother began to cry. My dad put his arm around her and patted her shoulder vaguely, like he didn't know what this was all about either. The three of us took up life together in the trailer, and we looked after him as best we could. But my dad was sick, and he couldn't get any better. I worked with him in the mill that summer and part of the fall. We'd get up in the mornings and eat eggs and toast while we listened to the radio, and then go out the door with our lunch pails. We'd pass through the gate together at 8 in the morning, and I wouldn't see him again until quitting time. In November, I went back to Yakima to be closer to my girlfriend, the girl I'd made up my mind I was going to marry. He worked at the mill in Chester until the following February, when he collapsed on the job and was taken to the hospital. My mother asked if I could come down there and help. I caught a bus from Yakima to Chester, intending to drive them back to Yakima. But now, in addition to being physically sick, my dad was in the midst of a nervous breakdown, though none of us knew to call it that at the time. During the entire trip back to Yakima, he didn't speak, not even when asked a direct question. "How do you feel, Raymond? You okay, Dad?" He'd communicate, if he communicated at all, by moving his head or by turning his palms up as if to say he didn't know or care. The only time he said anything on the trip, and for nearly a month afterward, was when I was speeding down a gravel road in Oregon and the car muffler came loose. "You were going too fast," he said. Back in Yakima, a doctor saw to it that my dad went to a psychiatrist. My mother and dad had to go on relief, as it was called, and the county paid for the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist asked my dad, "Who is the president?" He'd had a question put to him that he could answer. "Ike," my dad said. Nevertheless, they put him on the 5th floor of Valley Memorial Hospital and began giving him electroshock treatments. I was married by then and about to start my own family. My dad was still locked up when my wife went into this same hospital, just 1 floor down, to have our first baby. After she had delivered, I went upstairs to give my dad the news. They let me in through a steel door and showed me where I could find him. He was sitting on a couch with a blanket over his lap. "Hey," I thought, "what in hell is happening to my dad?" I sat down next to him and told him he was a grandfather. He waited a minute, and then he said, "I feel like a grandfather." That's all he said. He didn't smile or move. He was in a big room with a lot of other people. And I hugged him, and he began to cry. Somehow he got out of there. But now came the years when he couldn't work and just sat around the house trying to figure out what next and what he'd done wrong in his life that he'd wound up like this. My mother went from job to crummy job. Much later, she referred to that time he was in the hospital and those years just afterward as when Raymond was sick. The word sick was never the same for me again. In 1964, through the help of a friend, he was lucky enough to be hired on at a mill in Klamath, California. He moved down there by himself to see if he could hack it. He lived not far from the mill, in a 1-room cabin not much different from the place he and my mother had started out living in when they went west. He scrawled letters to my mother, and if I called, she'd read them aloud to me over the phone. In the letters, he said it was touch and go. Every day that he went to work, he felt like it was the most important day of his life. But every day, he told her, made the next day that much easier. He said for her to tell me he said hello. If he couldn't sleep at night, he said, he thought about me and the good times we used to have. Finally, after a couple of months, he regained some of his confidence. He could do the work and didn't think he had to worry that he'd let anybody down ever again. When he was sure, he sent for my mother. He'd been off from work for 6 years and had lost everything in that time. Home, car, furniture, and appliances, including the big freezer that had been my mother's pride and joy. He'd lost his good name, too. Raymond Carver was someone who couldn't pay his bills, and his self-respect was gone. He'd even lost his virility. My mother told my wife, "All during that time Raymond was sick, we slept together in the same bed, but we didn't have relations. He wanted to a few times, but nothing happened. I didn't miss it, but I think he wanted to, you know." During those years, I was trying to raise my own family and earn a living. But one thing and another, we found ourselves having to move a lot. I couldn't keep track of what was going down in my dad's life, but I did have a chance one Christmas to tell him I wanted to be a writer. I might as well have told him I wanted to become a plastic surgeon. "What are you going to write about?" he wanted to know. Then, as if to help me out, he said, "Write about stuff you know about. Write about some of those fishing trips we took." I said I would, but I knew I wouldn't. "Send me what you write," he said. I said I'd do that, but then I didn't. I wasn't writing anything about fishing, and I didn't think he'd particularly care about or even necessarily understand what I was writing in those days. Besides, he wasn't a reader. Not the sort anyway I imagined I was writing for. And he died. I was a long way off in Iowa City with things still to say to him. I didn't have the chance to tell him goodbye or that I thought he was doing great at his new job, that I was proud of him for making a comeback. My mother said he came in from work that night and ate a big supper. Then he sat at the table by himself and finished what was left of a bottle of whiskey, a bottle she found hidden in the bottom of the garbage under some coffee grounds a day or so later. Then he got up and went to bed, where my mother joined him a little later. But in the night, she had to get up and make a bed for herself on the couch. "He was snoring so loud I couldn't sleep," she said. The next morning, when she looked in on him, he was on his back with his mouth open, his cheeks caved in. "Gray-looking," she said. She knew he was dead. She didn't need a doctor to tell her that. But she called one anyway. And then she called my wife. Among the pictures my mother kept of my dad and herself during those early days in Washington was a photograph of him standing in front of a car, holding a beer and a stringer of fish. In the photograph, he is wearing his black hat on his forehead and has this awkward grin on his face. I asked her for it, and she gave it to me, along with some others. I put it up on my wall, and each time we moved, I took the picture along and put it up on another wall. I looked at it carefully from time to time, trying to figure out some things about my dad and maybe myself in the process, but I couldn't. My dad just kept moving further and further away from me and back into time. Finally, in the course of another move, I lost the photograph. It was then that I tried to recall it and at the same time make an attempt to say something about my dad and how I thought that in some important ways we might be alike. I wrote the poem when I was living in an apartment house in an urban area south of San Francisco, at a time when I found myself, like my dad, having trouble with alcohol. The poem was a way of trying to connect up with him. Photograph of my father in his 22nd year. October. Here in this dank, unfamiliar kitchen, I study my father's embarrassed young man's face. Sheepish grin. He holds in one hand a string of spiny yellow perch, in the other a bottle of Carlsberg beer. In jeans and flannel shirt, he leans against the front fender of a 1934 Ford. He would like to pose brave and hearty for his posterity, wear his old hat cocked over his ear. All his life, my father wanted to be bold. But the eyes gave him away, and the hands that limply offer the string of dead perch and the bottle of beer. Father, I love you, yet how can I say thank you, I who can't hold my liquor either, and don't even know the places to fish. The poem is true in its particulars, except that my dad died in June and not October, as the first word of the poem says. I wanted a word with more than one syllable to it, to make it linger a little. But more than that, I wanted a month appropriate to what I felt at the time I wrote the poem. A month of short days and failing light, smoke in the air, things perishing. June was summer nights and days, graduations, my wedding anniversary, the birthday of one of my children. June wasn't a month your father died in. After the service at the funeral home, after we had moved outside, a woman I didn't know came over to me and said, "He's happier where he is now." I stared at this woman until she moved away. I still remember the little knob of a hat she was wearing. Then one of my dad's cousins, I didn't know the man's name, reached out and took my hand. "We all miss him," he said. and I knew he wasn't saying it just to be polite. I began to weep for the first time since receiving the news. I hadn't been able to before. I hadn't had the time, for one thing. Now, suddenly, I couldn't stop. I held my wife and wept while she said and did what she could do to comfort me there in the middle of that summer afternoon. I listened to people say consoling things to my mother, and I was glad that my dad's family had turned up, had come to where he was. I thought I'd remember everything that was said and done that day and maybe find a way to tell it sometime. But I didn't. I forgot it all, or nearly. What I do remember is that I heard our name used a lot that afternoon, my dad's name and mine. But I knew they were talking about my dad. Raymond, these people kept saying in their beautiful voices out of my childhood. Raymond. On writing. Back in the mid-1960s, I found I was having trouble concentrating my attention on long narrative fiction. For a time, I experienced difficulty in trying to read it as well as in attempting to write it. My attention span had gone out on me. I no longer had the patience to try to write novels. It's an involved story, too tedious to talk about here. But I know it has much to do now with why I write poems and short stories. Get in, get out, don't linger, go on. It could be that I lost any great ambitions at about the same time in my late 20s. If I did, I think it was good it happened. Ambition and a little luck are good things for a writer to have going for him. Too much ambition and bad luck, or no luck at all, can be killing. There has to be talent. Some writers have a bunch of talent. I don't know any writers who are without it. But a unique and exact way of looking at things, and finding the right context for expressing that way of looking, that's something else. The world according to Garp is, of course, the marvelous world according to John Irving. There is another world according to Flannery O'Connor, and others according to William Faulkner and Ernest Hemingway. There are worlds according to Cheever, Updike, Singer, Stanley Elkin, Anne Beattie, Cynthia Ozick, Donald Barthelme, Mary Robeson, William Kittredge, Barry Hanna, Ursula K. Le Guin. Every great or even every very good writer makes the world over according to his own specifications. It's akin to style, what I'm talking about, but it isn't style alone. It's the writer's particular and unmistakable signature on everything he writes. It is his world and no other. This is one of the things that distinguishes one writer from another. Not talent. There's plenty of that around. But a writer who has some special way of looking at things and who gives artistic expression to that way of looking, that writer may be around for a time. Isak Dinesen said that she wrote a little every day, without hope and without despair. Someday I'll put that on a 3x5 card and tape it to the wall beside my desk. I have some 3x5 cards on the wall now. Fundamental accuracy of statement is the one sole morality of writing, Ezra Pound. It is not everything by any means, but if a writer has fundamental accuracy of statement going for him, he's at least on the right track. I have a 3x5 up there with this fragment of a sentence from a story by Chekhov, and suddenly everything became clear to him. I find these words filled with wonder and possibility. I love their simple clarity, and the hint of revelation that's implied. There is mystery, too. What has been unclear before? Why is it just now becoming clear? What's happened? Most of all, what now? There are consequences as a result of such sudden awakenings. I feel a sharp sense of relief and anticipation. I overheard the writer Jeffrey Wolfe say, "No cheap tricks," to a group of writing students. That should go on a 3x5 card. I'll amend it a little to "no tricks," period. I hate tricks. At the first sign of a trick or a gimmick in a piece of fiction, a cheap trick or even an elaborate trick, I tend to look for cover. Tricks are ultimately boring, and I get bored easily, which may go along with my not having much of an attention span. But extremely clever shishi writing or just plain tomfoolery writing puts me to sleep. Riders don't need tricks or gimmicks or even necessarily need to be the smartest fellows on the block. At the risk of appearing foolish, a rider sometimes needs to be able to just stand and gape at this or that thing, a sunset or an old shoe, in absolute and simple amazement. Some months back, in the New York Times book review, John Barth said that 10 years ago, most of the students in his fiction writing seminar were interested in formal innovation, and this no longer seems to be the case. He's a little worried that writers are going to start writing mom-and-pop novels in the 1980s. He worries that experimentation may be on the way out, along with liberalism. I get a little nervous if I find myself within earshot of somber discussions about formal innovation in fiction writing. Too often, experimentation is a license to be careless, silly, or imitative in the writing. Even worse, a license to try to brutalize or alienate the reader. Too often, such writing gives us no news of the world, or else describes a desert landscape, and that's all. A few dunes and lizards here and there, but no people. A place uninhabited by anything recognizably human, a place of interest only to a few scientific specialists. It should be noted that real experiment in fiction is original, hard-earned, and cause for rejoicing. But someone else's way of looking at things, Barthelme's, for instance, should not be chased after by other writers. It won't work. There is only one Barthelme, and for another writer to try to appropriate Barthelme's peculiar sensibility or mise-en-scène under the rubric of innovation is for that writer to mess around with chaos and disaster and, worse, self-deception. The real experimenters have to make it new, as Pound urged, and in the process have to find things out for themselves. Note, make it new. Title of Ezra Pound's 1934 essay collection, the phrase is a credo of Pound's attempt to revitalize tradition. End of note. But if writers haven't taken leave of their senses, they also want to stay in touch with us. They want to carry news from their world to ours. It's possible, in a poem or a short story, to write about commonplace things and objects, using commonplace but precise language, and to endow those things, a chair, a window curtain, a fork, a stone, a woman's earring, with immense, even startling, power. It is possible to write a line of seemingly innocuous dialogue and have it send a chill along the reader's spine. The source of artistic delight, as Nabokov would have it. That's the kind of writing that most interests me. I hate sloppy or haphazard writing, whether it flies under the banner of experimentation or else is just clumsily rendered realism. In Isaac Babel's wonderful short story, Guy de Maupassant, the narrator has this to say about the writing of fiction. No iron can pierce the heart with such force as a period put just at the right place. This, too, ought to go on a 3x5. Evan Connell said once that he knew he was finished with a short story when he found himself going through it and taking out commas, and then going through the story again and putting commas back in the same places. Note, Evan Connell. Novelist, short story writer, and biographer Evan S. Connell, born 1924, author of Mr. Bridge, 1958, Mrs. Bridge, 1969, Custer, Son of the Morning Star, 1984, and many other books. End of note. I like that way of working on something. I respect that kind of care for what is being done. That's all we have, finally, the words, and they had better be the right ones, with the punctuation in the right places so that they can best say what they are meant to say. If the words are heavy with the writer's own unbridled emotions, or if they are imprecise and inaccurate for some other reason, if the words are in any way blurred, the reader's eyes will slide right over them and nothing will be achieved. The reader's own artistic sense will simply not be engaged. Henry James called this sort of hapless writing weak specification. Note, see James's 1908 preface to The Turn of the Screw. Make him think the evil, make him think it for himself, and you are released from weak specifications. End of note. I have friends who've told me they had to hurry a book because they needed the money. Their editor or their wife was leaning on them or leaving them something, some apology for the writing not being very good. It would have been better if I'd taken the time. I was dumbfounded when I heard a novelist friend say this. I still am if I think about it, which I don't. It's none of my business. But if the writing can't be made as good as it is within us to make it, then why do it? In the end, the satisfaction of having done our best, and the proof of that labor, is the one thing we can take into the grave. I wanted to say to my friend, for heaven's sake, go do something else. There have to be easier and maybe more honest ways to try and earn a living. Or else just do it to the best of your abilities, your talents, and then don't justify or make excuses. Don't complain, don't explain. In an essay called, simply enough, Writing Short Stories, Flannery O'Connor talks about writing as an act of discovery. O'Connor says she most often did not know where she was going when she sat down to work on a short story. She says she doubts that many writers know where they are going when they begin something. She uses Good Country People as an example of how she put together a short story whose ending she could not even guess at until she was nearly there. When I started writing that story, I didn't know there was going to be a PhD with a wooden leg in it. I merely found myself one morning writing a description of two women I knew something about, and before I realized it, I had equipped one of them with a daughter with a wooden leg. I brought in the Bible salesman, but I had no idea what I was going to do with him. I didn't know he was going to steal that wooden leg until 10 or 12 lines before he did it. But when I found out that this was what was going to happen, I realized it was inevitable. When I read this some years ago, it came as a shock that she, or anyone for that matter, wrote stories in this fashion. I thought this was my uncomfortable secret, and I was a little uneasy with it. For sure, I thought this way of working on a short story somehow revealed my own shortcomings. I remember being tremendously heartened by reading what she had to say on the subject. I once sat down to write what turned out to be a pretty good story, though only the first sentence of the story had offered itself to me when I began it. For several days I'd been going around with this sentence in my head. He was running the vacuum cleaner when the telephone rang. Note: compare the opening line of Put Yourself in My Shoes. See Note 101.2-3. The telephone rang while he was running the vacuum cleaner. End of note. I knew a story was there and that it wanted telling. I felt it in my bones, that a story belonged with that beginning, if I could just have the time to write it. I found the time, an entire day, 12, 15 hours even, if I wanted to make use of it. I did, and I sat down in the morning and wrote the first sentence, and other sentences promptly began to attach themselves. I made the story just as I'd make a poem, one line and then the next. And the next. Pretty soon I could see a story, and I knew it was my story, the one I'd been wanting to write. I like it when there is some feeling of threat or sense of menace in short stories. I think a little menace is fine to have in a story. For one thing, it's good for the circulation. There has to be tension, a sense that something is imminent, that certain things are in relentless motion, or else, most often, there simply won't be a story. What creates tension in a piece of fiction is partly the way the concrete words are linked together to make up the visible action of the story, but it's also the things that are left out, that are implied, the landscape just under the smooth, but sometimes broken and unsettled, surface of things. V.S. Pritchett's definition of a short story is something glimpsed from the corner of the eye in passing. Notice the glimpse part of this. First, the glimpse. Then the glimpse given life, turned into something that illuminates the moment and may, if we're lucky, that word again, have even further ranging consequences and meaning. The short story writer's task is to invest the glimpse with all that is in his power. He'll bring his intelligence and literary skill to bear, his talent, his sense of proportion and sense of the fitness of things, of how things out there really are and how he sees those things. Like no one else sees them. And this is done through the use of clear and specific language, language used so as to bring to life the details that will light up the story for the reader. For the details to be concrete and convey meaning, the language must be accurate and precisely given. The words can be so precise they may even sound flat, but they can still carry. If used right, they can hit all the notes. Fires. Influences are forces, circumstances, personalities, irresistible as the tide. I can't talk about books or writers who might have influenced me. That kind of influence, literary influence, is hard for me to pin down with any kind of certainty. It would be as inaccurate for me to say I've been influenced by everything I've read as for me to say I don't think I've been influenced by any writers. For instance, I've long been a fan of Ernest Hemingway's novels and short stories. Yet I think Lawrence Durrell's work is singular and unsurpassed in the language. Of course, I don't write like Durrell. He's certainly no influence. On occasion, it's been said that my writing is like Hemingway's writing, but I can't say his writing influenced mine. Hemingway is one of the many writers whose work, like Durrell's, I first read and admired when I was in my 20s. So I don't know about literary influences, but I do have some notions about other kinds of influences. The influences I know something about have pressed on me in ways that were often mysterious at first glance, sometimes stopping just short of the miraculous. But these influences have become clear to me as my work has progressed. These influences were, and they still are, relentless. These were the influences that sent me in this direction, onto this spit of land instead of some other, that one over there on the far side of the lake, for example. But if the main influence on my life and writing has been a negative one, oppressive and often malevolent, as I believe is the case, what am I to make of this? Let me begin by saying that I'm writing this at a place called Yaddo, which is just outside of Saratoga Springs, New York. It's afternoon, Sunday, early August. Every so often, every 25 minutes or so, I can hear upwards of 30,000 voices joined in a great outcry. This wonderful clamor comes from the Saratoga Racecourse. A famous meet is in progress. I'm writing, but every 25 minutes I can hear the announcer's voice coming over the loudspeaker as he calls the positions of the horses. The roar of the crowd increases. It bursts over the trees, a great and truly thrilling sound, rising until the horses have crossed the finish line. When it's over, I feel spent, as if I too had participated. I can imagine holding pari-mutuel tickets on one of the horses who finished in the money, or even a horse who came close. If it's a photo finish at the wire, I can expect to hear another outburst a minute or two later, after the film has been developed and the official results posted. For several days now, ever since arriving here, and upon first hearing the announcer's voice over the loudspeaker and the excited roar from the crowd, I've been writing a short story set in El Paso, a city where I lived for a while some time ago. The story has to do with some people who go to a horse race at a track outside of El Paso. I don't want to say the story has been waiting to be written. It hasn't, and it would make it sound like something else to say that. But I needed something, in the case of this particular story, to push it out into the open. Then after I arrived here at Yaddo, and first heard the crowd, and the announcer's voice came over the loudspeaker, certain things came back to me from that other life in El Paso and suggested the story. I remembered that track I went to down there and some things that took place, that might have taken place, that will take place, in my story anyway, 2,000 miles away from here. So my story is underway, and there is that aspect of influences. Of course, every writer is subject to this kind of influence. This is the most common kind of influence. This suggests that, that suggests something else. It's the kind of influence that is as common to us, and as natural, as rainwater. But before I go on to what I want to talk about, let me give one more example of influence akin to the first. Not so long ago in Syracuse, where I live, I was in the middle of writing a short story when my telephone rang. I answered it. On the other end of the line was the voice of a man who was obviously a black man, someone asking for a party named Nelson. It was a wrong number, and I said so and hung up. I went back to my short story. But pretty soon I found myself writing a black character into my story, a somewhat sinister character whose name was Nelson. At that moment, the story took a different turn. But happily it was, I see now, and somehow knew at the time, the right turn for the story. When I began to write that story, I could not have prepared for or predicted the necessity for the presence of Nelson in the story. But now, the story finished and about to appear in a national magazine, I see it as right and appropriate and, I believe, aesthetically correct that Nelson be there, and be there with his sinister aspect. Also right for me is that this character found his way into my story with a coincidental rightness I had the good sense to trust. I have a poor memory. By this I mean that much that has happened in my life I've forgotten, a blessing for sure. But I have these large periods of time I simply can't account for or bring back. Towns and cities I've lived in, names of people, the people themselves, large blanks. But I can remember some things. Little things. Somebody saying something in a particular way. Somebody's wild or low, nervous laughter. A landscape. An expression of sadness or bewilderment on somebody's face. And I can remember some dramatic things. Somebody picking up a knife and turning to me in anger. Or else hearing my own voice threaten somebody else. Seeing somebody break down a door. Or else fall down a flight of stairs. Some of those more dramatic kinds of memories I can recall when it's necessary. But I don't have the kind of memory that can bring entire conversations back to the present, complete with all the gestures and nuances of real speech. Nor can I recall the furnishings of any room I've ever spent time in, not to mention my inability to remember the furnishings of an entire household. Or even very many specific things about a racetrack. Except, let's see, a grandstand, betting windows, closed-circuit TV screens, masses of people, hubbub. I make up the conversations in my stories. I put the furnishings and the physical things surrounding the people into the stories as I need those things. Perhaps this is why it's sometimes been said that my stories are unadorned, stripped down, even minimalist. But maybe it's nothing more than a working marriage of necessity and convenience that has brought me to writing the kind of stories I do in the way that I do. None of my stories really happened, of course. I'm not writing autobiography. But most of them bear a resemblance, however faint, to certain life occurrences or situations. But when I try to recall the physical surroundings or furnishings bearing on a story situation, what kind of flowers, if any, were present, did they give off any odor, etc.? I'm often at a total loss. So I have to make it up as I go along, what the people in the story say to each other, as well as what they do then, after thus and so was said, and what happens to them next. I make up what they say to each other, though there may be, in the dialogue, some actual phrase or sentence or two that I once heard given in a particular context at some time or other. That sentence may even have been my starting point for the story. When Henry Miller was in his 40s and was writing Tropic of Cancer, a book, incidentally, that I like very much, he talks about trying to write in this borrowed room, where at any minute he may have to stop writing because the chair he is sitting on may be taken out from under him. Until fairly recently, this state of affairs persisted in my own life. For as long as I can remember, since I was a teenager, the imminent removal of the chair from under me was a constant concern. For years and years, my wife and I met ourselves coming and going as we tried to keep a roof over our heads and put bread and milk on the table. We had no money, no visible, that is to say, marketable skills, nothing that we could do toward earning anything better than a get-by living. And we had no education, though we each wanted one very badly. Education, we believed, would open doors for us, help us get jobs so that we could make the kind of life we wanted for ourselves and our children. We had great dreams, my wife and I. We thought we could bow our necks, work very hard, and do all that we had set our hearts to do, but we were mistaken. I have to say that the greatest single influence on my life and on my writing, directly and indirectly, has been my two children. They were born before I was 20, and from beginning to end of our habitation under the same roof, some 19 years in all, there wasn't any area of my life where their heavy and often baleful influence didn't reach. In one of her essays, Flannery O'Connor says that not much needs to happen in a writer's life after the writer is 20 years old. Plenty of the stuff that makes fiction has already happened to the writer before that time. More than enough, she says. Enough things to last the writer the rest of his creative life. This is not true for me. Most of what now strikes me as story material presented itself to me after I was 20. I really don't remember much about my life before I became a parent. I really don't feel that anything happened in my life until I was 20 and married and had the kids. Then things started to happen. In the mid-1960s, I was in a busy laundromat in Iowa City, trying to do 5 or 6 loads of clothes, kids' clothes for the most part, but some of our own clothing, of course, my wife's and mine. My wife was working as a waitress for the University Athletic Club that Saturday afternoon. I was doing chores and being responsible for the kids. They were with some other kids that afternoon, a birthday party maybe, something. But right then, I was doing the laundry. I'd already had sharp words with an old harridan over the number of washers I'd had to use. Now I was waiting for the next round with her, or someone else like her. I was nervously keeping an eye on the dryers that were in operation in the crowded laundromat. When and if one of the dryers ever stopped, I planned to rush over to it with my shopping basket of damp clothes. Understand, I'd been hanging around in the laundromat for 30 minutes or so with this basket full of clothes, waiting my chance. I'd already missed out on a couple of dryers. Somebody had gotten there first. I was getting frantic. As I say, I'm not sure where our kids were that afternoon. Maybe I had to pick them up from someplace, and it was getting late, and that contributed to my state of mind. I did know that even if I could get my clothes into a dryer, it would still be another hour or more before the clothes would dry, and I could sack them up and go home with them, back to our apartment in married student housing. Finally, a dryer came to a stop, and I was right there when it did. The clothes inside quit tumbling and lay still. In 30 seconds or so, if no one showed up to claim them, I planned to get rid of the clothes and replace them with my own. That's the law of the laundromat. But at that minute, a woman came over to the dryer and opened the door. I stood there waiting. This woman put her hand into the machine and took hold of some items of clothing. But they weren't dry enough, she decided. She closed the door and put 2 more dimes into the machine. In a daze, I moved away with my shopping cart and went back to waiting. But I remember thinking at that moment, amid the feelings of helpless frustration that had me close to tears, that nothing, and brother, I mean nothing, that ever happened to me on this earth could come anywhere close, could possibly be as important to me, could make as much difference as the fact that I had 2 children. And that I would always have them and always find myself in this position of unrelieved responsibility and permanent distraction. I'm talking about real influence now. I'm talking about the moon and the tide. But like that, it came to me, like a sharp breeze when the window is thrown open. Up to that point in my life, I'd gone along thinking, what exactly, I don't know, but that things would work out somehow, that everything in my life I'd hoped for or wanted to do was possible. But at that moment, in the laundromat, I realized that this simply was not true. I realized, what had I been thinking before? That my life was a small change thing for the most part, chaotic and without much light showing through. At that moment I felt, I knew, that the life I was in was vastly different from the lives of the writers I most admired. I understood writers to be people who didn't spend their Saturdays at the laundromat and every waking hour subject to the needs and caprices of their children. Sure, there have been plenty of writers who have had far more serious impediments to their work, including imprisonment, blindness, the threat of torture or of death in one form or another. But knowing this was no consolation. At that moment, I swear all of this took place there in the laundromat, I could see nothing ahead but years more of this kind of responsibility and perplexity. Things would change some, but they were never really going to get better. I understood this, but could I live with it? At that moment, I saw accommodations would have to be made. The sights would have to be lowered. I'd had, I realized later, an insight. But so what? What are insights? They don't help any. They just make things harder. For years, my wife and I had held to a belief that if we worked hard and tried to do the right things would happen. It's not such a bad thing to try and build a life on. Hard work, goals, good intentions, loyalty. We believed these were virtues that would someday be rewarded. We dreamt when we had the time for it. But eventually, we realized that hard work and dreams were not enough. Somewhere, in Iowa City maybe, or shortly afterwards in Sacramento, the dreams began to go bust. The time came and went when everything my wife and I held sacred or considered worthy of respect, every spiritual value crumbled away. Something terrible had happened to us. It was something that we had never seen occur in any other family. We couldn't fully comprehend what had happened. It was erosion, and we couldn't stop it. Somehow, when we weren't looking, the children had got into the driver's seat. As crazy as it sounds now, they held the reins and the whip. We simply could not have anticipated anything like what was happening to us. During these ferocious years of parenting, I usually didn't have the time or the heart to think about working on anything very lengthy. The circumstances of my life, the grip and slog of it, in D.H. Lawrence's phrase, did not permit it. The circumstances of my life with these children dictated something else. They said if I wanted to write anything and finish it, and if I ever wanted to take satisfaction out of finished work, I was going to have to stick to stories and poems. The short things I could sit down and, with any luck, write quickly and have done with. Very early, long before Iowa City even, I'd understood that I would have a hard time writing a novel, given my anxious inability to focus on anything for a sustained period of time. Looking back on it now, I think I was slowly going nuts with frustration during those ravenous years. Anyway, these circumstances dictated, to the fullest possible extent, the forms my writing could take. God forbid I'm not complaining now, just giving facts from a heavy and still bewildered heart. If I'd been able to collect my thoughts and concentrate my energy on a novel, say, I was still in no position to wait for a payoff that, if it came at all, might be several years down the road. I couldn't see the road. I had to sit down and write something I could finish now, tonight, or at least tomorrow night, no later, after I got in from work and before I lost interest. In those days, I always worked some crap job or other, and my wife did the same. She waitressed, or else was a door-to-door saleswoman. Years later, she taught high school, but that was years later. I worked sawmill jobs, janitor jobs, delivery man jobs, service station jobs, stockroom boy jobs. Name it, I did it. One summer, in Arcata, California, I picked tulips, I swear, during the daylight hours to support us, and at night after closing, I cleaned the inside of a drive-in restaurant and swept up the parking lot. Once I even considered, for a few minutes anyway, the job application form there in front of me, becoming a bill collector. In those days, I figured if I could squeeze in an hour or two a day for myself, after job and family, that was more than good enough. That was heaven itself. And I felt happy to have that hour. But sometimes, one reason or another, I couldn't get the hour. Then I would look forward to Saturday, though sometimes things happened that knocked Saturday out as well. But there was Sunday to hope for. Sunday, maybe. I couldn't see myself working on a novel in such a fashion, that is to say, no fashion at all. To write a novel, it seemed to me, a writer should be living in a world that makes sense, a world that the writer can believe in, draw a bead on, and then write about accurately, a world that will, for a time anyway, stay fixed in one place. Along with this, there has to be a belief in the essential correctness of that world, a belief that the known world has reasons for existing and is worth writing about, is not likely to go up in smoke in the process. This wasn't the case with the world I knew and was living in. My world was one that seemed to change gears and directions, along with its rules, every day. Time and again I reached the point where I couldn't see or plan any further ahead than the first of next month, and gathering together enough money, by hook or by crook, to meet the rent and provide the children's school clothes. This is true. I wanted to see tangible results for any so-called literary efforts of mine. No chits or promises, no time certificates, please. So I purposely, and by necessity, limited myself to writing things I knew I could finish in one sitting, two sittings at the most. I'm talking of a first draft now. I've always had the patience for rewriting. But in those days, I happily looked forward to the rewriting as it took up time which I was glad to have taken up. In one regard, I was in no hurry to finish the story or the poem I was working on, for finishing something meant I'd have to find the time and the belief to begin something else. So I had great patience with a piece of work after I'd done the initial writing. I'd keep something around the house for what seemed a very long time, fooling with it, changing this, adding that, cutting out something else. This hit-and-miss way of writing lasted for nearly 2 decades. There were good times back there, of course. Certain grown-up pleasures and satisfactions that only parents have access to. But I'd take poison before I'd go through that time again. The circumstances of my life are much different now. But now I choose to write short stories and poems. Or at least I think I do. Maybe it's all a result of the old writing habits from those days. Maybe I still can't adjust to thinking in terms of having a great swatch of time in which to work on something, anything I want, and not have to worry about having the chair yanked out from under me, or one of my kids smarting off about why supper isn't ready on demand. But I learned some things along the way. One of the things I learned is that I had to bend or else break. I also learned that it is possible to bend and break at the same time. I'll say something about two other individuals who exercised influence on my life. One of them, John Gardner, was teaching a beginning fiction writing course at Chico State College when I signed up for the class in the fall of 1958. My wife and I and the children had just moved down from Yakima, Washington, to a place called Paradise, California, about 10 miles up in the foothills outside of Chico. We had the promise of low-rent housing and, of course, we thought it would be a great adventure to move to California. In those days, and for a long while after, we were always up for an adventure. Of course, I'd have to work on earning a living for us, but I also planned to enroll in college as a part-time student. Gardner was just out of the University of Iowa with a PhD and, I knew, several unpublished novels and short stories. I'd never met anyone who'd written a novel, published or otherwise. On the first day of class, he marched us outside and had us sit on the lawn. There were 6 or 7 of us, as I recall. He went around, asking us to name the authors we liked to read. I can't remember any names we mentioned, but they must not have been the right names. He announced that he didn't think any of us had what it took to become real writers. As far as he could see, none of us had the necessary fire. But he said he was going to do what he could for us, though it was obvious he didn't expect much to come of it. But there was an implication, too, that we were about to set off on a trip, and we'd do well to hold on to our hats. I remember at another class meeting, he said he wasn't going to mention any of the big circulation magazines except to sneer at them. He'd brought in a stack of little magazines, the literary quarterlies, and he told us to read the work in those magazines. He told us that this was where the best fiction in the country was being published, and all of the poetry. He said he was there to tell us which authors to read as well as teach us how to write. He was amazingly arrogant. He gave us a list of the little magazines he thought were worth something, and he went down the list with us and talked about each magazine. Of course, none of us had ever heard of these magazines. It was the first I'd ever known of their existence. I remember him saying during this time, it might have been during a conference, that writers were made as well as born. Is this true? My God, I still don't know. I suppose every writer who teaches creative writing and who takes the job at all seriously has to believe this to some extent. There are apprentice musicians and composers and visual artists, so why not writers? I was impressionable then. I suppose I still am. But I was terrifically impressed with everything he said and did. He'd take one of my early efforts at a story and go over it with me. I remember him as being very patient, wanting me to understand what he was trying to show me, telling me over and over how important it was to have the right words, saying what I wanted them to say. Nothing vague or blurred, no smoked glass prose. And he kept drumming at me the importance of using, I don't know how else to say it, common language. The language of normal discourse, the language we speak to each other in. Recently, we had dinner together in Ithaca, New York, and I reminded him then of some of the sessions we'd had up in his office. He answered that probably everything he'd told me was wrong. He said, "I've changed my mind about so many things. All I know is that the advice he was handing out in those days was just what I needed at that time. He was a wonderful teacher. It was a great thing to have happen to me at that period of my life, to have someone who took me seriously enough to sit down and go over a manuscript with me. I knew something crucial was happening to me, something that mattered. He helped me to see how important it was to say exactly what I wanted to say and nothing else, not to use literary words or pseudo-poetic language. He tried to explain to me the difference between saying something like, for example, wing of a meadowlark and meadowlark's wing. There's a different sound and feel, yes. The word ground and the word earth, for instance. Ground is ground, he'd say. It means ground, dirt, that kind of stuff. But if you say earth, that's something else. That word has other ramifications. He taught me to use contractions in my writing. He helped show me how to say what I wanted to say and use the minimum number of words to do so. He made me see that absolutely everything was important in a short story. It was of consequence where the commas and periods went. For this, for that, for his giving me the key to his office so I would have a place to write on the weekends, for his putting up with my brashness and general nonsense, I'll always be grateful. He was an influence. 10 years later, I was still alive, still living with my children, still writing an occasional story or poem. I sent one of the occasional stories to Esquire, and in so doing hoped to be able to forget about it for a while. But the story came back by return mail, along with a letter from Gordon Lish, at that time the fiction editor for the magazine. He said he was returning the story. He was not apologizing that he was returning it, not returning it reluctantly. He was just returning it. But he asked to see others. So I promptly sent him everything I had, and he just as promptly sent everything back. But again, a friendly letter accompanied the work I'd sent to him. At that time, the early 1970s, I was living in Palo Alto with my family. I was in my early 30s, and I had my first white-collar job. I was an editor for a textbook publishing firm. We lived in a house that had an old garage out back. The previous tenants had built a playroom in the garage, and I'd go out to this garage every night I could manage after dinner and try to write something. If I couldn't write anything, and this was often the case, I'd just sit there for a while by myself, thankful to be away from the fracas that always seemed to be raging inside the house. But I was writing a short story that I'd called The Neighbors. I finally finished the story and sent it off to Lish. A letter came back almost immediately telling me how much he liked it, that he was changing the title to Neighbors, that he was recommending to the magazine that the story be purchased. It was purchased, it did appear, and nothing, it seemed to me, would ever be the same. Esquire soon bought another story, and then another, and so on. James Dickey became poetry editor of the magazine during this time, and he began accepting my poems for publication. In one regard, things had never seemed better. But my kids were in full cry then, like the racetrack crowd I can hear at this moment, and they were eating me alive. My life soon took another veering, a sharp turn, and then it came to a dead stop on a siding. I couldn't go anywhere, couldn't back up or go forward. It was during this period that Lish collected some of my stories and gave them to McGraw-Hill, who published them. For the time being, I was still off on the siding, unable to move in any direction. If there'd once been a fire, it had gone out. Influences: John Gardner and Gordon Lish. They hold irredeemable notes. But my children are it. Theirs is the main influence. They were the prime movers and shapers of my life and my writing. As you can see, I'm still under their influence. Though the days are relatively clear now, and the silences are right. Author's note to Where I'm Calling From. I wrote and published my first short story in 1963, 25 years ago, and have been drawn to short story writing ever since. I think in part, but only in part, this inclination toward brevity and intensity has to do with the fact that I am a poet as well as a story writer. I began writing and publishing poetry and fiction at more or less the same time, back in the early 1960s when I was still an undergraduate. But this dual relationship as poet and short story writer doesn't explain everything. I'm hooked on writing short stories and couldn't get off them even if I wanted to, which I don't. I love the swift leap of a good story, the excitement that often commences in the first sentence, the sense of beauty and mystery found in the best of them, and the fact, so crucially important to me back at the beginning and even now still a consideration, that the story can be written and read in one sitting, like poems. In the beginning, and perhaps still, the most important short story writers to me were Isaac Babel, Anton Chekhov, Frank O'Connor, and V.S. Pritchett. I forget who first passed along a copy of Babel's collected stories to me, but I do remember coming across a line from one of his greatest stories. I copied it into the little notebook I carried around with me everywhere in those days. The narrator, speaking about Maupassant and the writing of fiction, says, "No iron can stab the heart with such force as a period, put just at the right place." When I first read this, it came to me with the force of revelation. This is what I wanted to do with my own stories. Line up the right words, the precise images, as well as the exact and correct punctuation so that the reader got pulled in and involved in the story and wouldn't be able to turn away his eyes from the text unless the house caught fire. Vain wishes, perhaps, to ask words to assume the power of actions, but clearly a young writer's wishes. Still, the idea of writing clearly with authority enough to hold and engage the reader persisted. This remains one of my primary goals today. My first book of stories, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, did not appear until 1976, 13 years after the first story was written. This long delay between composition, magazine, and book publication was due in part to a young marriage, the exigencies of child-rearing and blue-collar laboring jobs, a little education on the fly, and never enough money to go around at the end of each month. It was during this long period, too, that I was trying to learn my craft as a writer, how to be as subtle as a river current when very little else in my life was subtle. After the 13-year period it took to put the first book together and to find a publisher who, I might add, was most reluctant to engage in such a cockeyed enterprise, a first book of stories by an unknown writer, I tried to learn to write fast when I had the time, writing stories when the spirit was with me and letting them pile up in a drawer, and then going back to look at them carefully and coldly later on, from a remove, after things had calmed down, after things had, all too regrettably, gone back to normal. Inevitably, life being what it is, there were often great swatches of time that simply disappeared. Long periods when I did not write any fiction. How I wish I had those years back now. Sometimes a year or two would pass when I couldn't even think about writing stories. Often enough, though, I was able to spend some of that time writing poems, and this proved important because in writing the poetry, the flame didn't entirely putter out, as I sometimes feared it might. Mysteriously, or so it would seem to me, there would come a time to turn to fiction again. The circumstances in my life would be right, or at least improved, and the ferocious desire to write would take hold of me, and I would begin. I wrote Cathedral, 8 of these stories are reprinted here, in a period of 15 months. But during that 2-year period, before I began to work on those stories, I found myself in a period of stock-taking, of trying to discover where I wanted to go with whatever new stories I was going to write and how I wanted to write them. My previous book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, had been in many ways a watershed book for me, but it was a book I didn't want to duplicate or write again, so I simply waited. I taught at Syracuse University. I wrote some poems and book reviews, and an essay or two. And then one morning something happened. After a good night's sleep, I went to my desk and wrote the story Cathedral. I knew it was a different kind of story for me, No question. Somehow I had found another direction I wanted to move toward, and I moved, and quickly. The new stories that are included here, stories which were written after Cathedral and after I had intentionally, happily, taken time out for 2 years to write two books of poetry, are, I'm sure, different in kind and degree from the earlier stories. At least I think they're different from those earlier stories, and I suspect readers may feel the same. But any writer will tell you he wants to believe his work will undergo a metamorphosis, a sea change, a process of enrichment, if he's been at it long enough. V.S. Pritchett's definition of a short story is something glimpsed from the corner of the eye in passing. First the glimpse, then the glimpse given life, turned into something that will illuminate the moment and just maybe lock it indelibly into the reader's consciousness. Make it a part of the reader's own experience, as Hemingway so nicely put it. Forever, the writer hopes. Forever. If we're lucky, writer and reader alike, we'll finish the last line or two of a short story and then just sit for a minute, quietly. Ideally, we'll ponder what we've just written or read. Maybe our hearts or our intellects will have been moved off the peg just a little from where they were before. Our body temperature will have gone up or down by a degree. Then, breathing evenly and steadily once more, we'll collect ourselves, writers and readers alike, get up, created of warm blood and nerves, as a Chekhov character puts it, and go on to the next thing. Life. Always life. Note. Created of warm blood and nerves. See Chekhov's story, Ward No. 6, 1892. I only know that God has created me of warm blood and nerves. Yes, indeed. End of note.